Okay, are you there?
I am here, Jeff.
Great. Well, hello, this is Jeff Gaudiosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. I have a great guest for our conversation today. He is a multi-instrumentalist, writer, producer, and recently launched a new project called 3.2. Please welcome Robert Berry.
Hey, Jeff. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
What's the weather like there? I hate to tell you, it's about 70 degrees here in California. So.
Well, today is a balmy day. It's about 50 here in Connecticut. So.
Well,
we'll take it at this point.
Yeah, really. It's not snowing or raining or sneaked or anything.
Exactly. As long as it's not snow, we're happy. Before we get into the new 3.2, The Rules Have Changed record, let's go back a little bit in time to the original three. You were coming off a moderately successful run with your band Hush, as well as some solo work. How did you first team up with Keith Emerson and Carl Palmer?
You know, that is it's still amazing to me when I talk about this, because I have a recording studio here in Campbell, California, the heart of Silicon Valley. Main headquarters, two campuses here. A half a mile the other way is eBay, where it started. And 2 miles down the road is that big Apple campus, the big spaceship the round one, which, I'll tell you a funny thing, it's almost all glass, and they didn't want to put any things on the glass with little dots you put so you don't run into things. So people were breaking their noses in there. They finally put the dots on. It's almost all glass. It's an amazing building. That's 2 miles away. I'm in the heart of this. And I opened this studio, and I had it a couple of years. I was struggling with a brand-new business to get business in it, and my phone rings. And he's Carl Palmer. It's Robert Berry there. He had a high voice and an English accent. I'm thinking, oh, this is my friend. I did some albums and played drums with Richard Capps. It's got to be Richard. This sounds like him. I said, oh, yeah, here I am. I kind of cocky, right? What can I do for you? And I guess for him, playing with a lot of famous guys and he famous himself, that was a normal attitude, because he said, hi, Robert, this is Carl. Sitting here at Geffen Record with John Kalodner, and I really like your music. I like your voice. Would you be interested in starting a band? I'm like, nope. I mean, okay. Yeah, sure, Carl. I sort of pull it back a notch and get a little more respectful, you know.
Of course, yeah.
My manager is going to be in town with GTR next week. Go to San Francisco, meet him. We'll fly somewhere together, and we'll see what we do. It started that simply, except that Carl and I tried with a few people, Jolynn Turner from Rainbow, Don Aries from Ozzy's band, a bunch of guys who tried to start a band, and nothing clicked as well as Carl and I did. Carl flew me over, actually, Brian Lane, my manager, flew me to England. I was living in London. We were trying to get something together, and it just didn't happen. And Steve Howe calls. Well, this is Steve Howe. So, I'm thinking, I'm not going to do that again.
At this point, you're used to it.
I was in London then.
Yeah.
And he says, Steve Hackett has left, and I heard it was a cassette tape and a vinyl album in 1986, 87. CDs weren't really catching on until when 3 came out, the album in 88. It was kind of half vinyl and half CDs. So anyway, Steve said, why don't you come over? I want to see what kind of guy you are. So I went to his house, met his family and everything. It was a fantastic time in my life. He gave me a couple songs. He goes, let's see what you think of these. And I took them back to my flat, and they just seemed so wrong for the Steve Howe that he was my guitar hero. It was the one song was, you only have yourself to blame, like pointing the finger, right? Going, no. You don't want to hear that. We want to hear, I only have myself to blame. I'm a humble person. I can fix this. That's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I dive in all night and they rewrite, you only have you to blame, or I blame you, all that stuff. And I rewrite it to, no one else to blame but myself, basically. And I go back to Steve's the next day. I worked about 4 in the morning, got 4 hours sleep, back over to Steve's. I learned a long time ago that if you put yourself forward and you are who you are, that whoever it is that you're talking to, if you get a relationship going, it'll last forever. If you fake it, if you don't give them the best of you, or oh, okay, Steve Howe, let's see, well, let me make it like Queen. I think this should be a Queen song, you know.
Right.
It's taken it for me. I'm a big Yes fan, big Steve Howe fan. I made it what I thought would be great for Steve Howe. And he had me, I put it down as a track recorder, and I sang it, and I played guitar in front of Steve Howe. I'm going, oh, geez, this is really rough. And I changed his song. He's going to hate it, and this is going to be that. They're sending me home. I played it. He listened to it. And he didn't say a word the whole time I was putting it together. And he looked at me and he goes, nobody has worked on my material since John Anderson of Yes like this. This is fantastic. And I thought, wow, we really connected on this. And so we started writing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the band. We did demos. We got our next record funded. And the singer made it tough for me. He didn't want me singing. He just tried to wrestle me out of the picture as much as he could. The new guy, you know. An American, besides, only American, oh, my God, it'd be worse now, wouldn't it? So I decided to quit. And the next day I was going to go home, and my manager, Brian Lane, said, Keith Emerson wants to meet you for lunch. And that's how Three started. We met for lunch, had a two-hour lunch. He says, Carl, really likes your material. I've heard it. I like it. I want some of that Asia success that you've had with Asia. I think... But now's the time for me to get more into songs and do this, you know, AOR meets progressive rock. And as I know, you knew that first three album.
And of course.
We had some success here in the U.S., had a number nine single, and it launched me into a great life at my studio even. It affected my, once I came back here, my studio business, you know, people go, oh, you played with Keith Emerson, you must be good. I could have been terrible, but playing with Keith and Carl gave me a status of being a good musician, no matter how good or bad I was.
Oh, without a doubt. And one thing with that record is you mentioned now how they were looking for a little bit of that Asia success. It really was very different from what the public expected from Keith and Carl at the time. You know, you had songs like Talking About and Lover to Lover, which, you know, going back and listening now, were like, you know, your rock songs with Keith and Carl's flourish sort of layered on them. Are you surprised after all these years that it still holds up as well as it does, especially those two singles?
Well, you know, what it's kind of funny to me, and I've only really noticed this in the last couple of months, doing so many interviews and talking to so many people, Carl was never criticized for Three. Because he was in Asia, and they did songs with the progressive touch to him.
Mm-hmm.
Keith had never done it, so Keith was heavily criticized just by the super diehard ELP fans that wanted me out and Greg Lake back in, which I totally understood. I was a Greg Lake fan. That didn't bother me one bit. But they wanted Keith to only play hard stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was a problem, because Keith sort of took that to heart and thought that... his fan base was fleeing, but they weren't. We had a number nine song that was actually growing. But I am really pleasantly surprised that when a record company in 2015 put out a Live 3 in Boston CD, that the fans kind of came out of the woodwork and people saying, you know, I always liked that album. Because we felt like, because of what happened to Keith, the criticism of Keith, that there was more people in the progressive world, at least, that didn't like the album than the world that did like it. And I'm finding now that quite a few people really gave it a chance. There were certain things they liked about it, maybe a couple things they didn't.
Right.
But it really is something. And, you know, there's a Facebook page of this friend of mine now, but his name is Rolf, and he started Three Emerson Barry Palmer on Facebook, and he just keeps getting members. I've never seen that. I was in the band. And it's really cool to see that little discovery going on and people sort of coming back and then, of course, hooking on to 3.2, you know.
Right. And what are your memories of, you know, writing something like Talking About, you know, that was really the big single from the record?
I got to tell you a funny story about that.
Mm-hmm.
That Talking About, the fanfare part, with my studio being more 3-4 years old at the point, because I kept going back and forth from London back here, having to pay my bills, so I'd work 2 weeks straight in the studio day and night working for clients that wanted me to do things, and then I'd go back to England for 3 months and work, and this computer company that's long gone now, high-tech thing, I think they made digital graphic cards for computers. They wanted this big show, and the guy knew me, called me, goes, I need this piece of the fanfare kind of intro for our CEO to walk out on the stage. I said, okay. So I put a little drum beat down, real simple, and I did, bum, 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 drum roll. That was the chord structure for Talking About. When I actually got with Steve Howe, when I came back one time to the studio, I thought, gee, well, I've always liked that old fanfare thing. And I put together this song, and having girlfriend problems or something at the time, you know, whatever it was, the lyrics came out just kind of positive, like we could do it, we can do things together and make it happen and whatever it was. And I brought this song back to Steve Howe. It was actually done by Steve Howe in GTR first.
Oh, wow.
And he had there's a song called Going for the One, and yes, it has a vibrato on the guitar. It kind of goes, you know, like a Duane Eddy, an old thing.
Yeah.
And he did that, bow, 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 on the guitar, and it sounded really cool, but yeah, I thought, well, that's not really the power of the song. When I got together with Keith, I said, Keith, listen to this. I think, you know, I hear something that you could do, like, fanfare for the common man with this thing that would make it so tremendous. And sure enough, he did. He went in there. He made it so big. But it started with this little fanfare for a CEO to walk onto the stage during one of their pep rally kind of thing.
You never know where the seed will be planted.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, now let's jump forward 30 years to 3.2. What brought you and Keith back together for this project?
When that record company put out the 3 Live in Boston CD, they had called us all. They actually called his manager, Bruce Pilato, is the guy that was talking to us. He knew the record company, and he knew they wanted to put it out. He said, look, you know, there's an advance and this and that. And Keith said to me, he goes, yeah, you know, it's just a paycheck. It'll be money in the bank. That's fine, you know. So let's put it out. Can't hurt anything. He had really left 3 behind 27 years prior because the criticism he got, and only from a couple of people, because really there was no internet. There wasn't a whole lot of people like jump on where you could see what you were thinking instantly. A couple of guys sent him a letter, and they said, you have scantily clad girl back on singer. That's not good for your reputation, and you shouldn't be playing on songs. That's not good for your reputation. And he kind of took it to heart. So for 27 years, he really left it behind. He had done other things. You know, he played in a Tempest album for me. He's a Celtic band I produced. He did some TV commercials with me. He played on one of my solo songs. Just a bunch of stuff. And we talked every so often, you know. But he got this 3 in Boston CD in the mail. And instead of just tossing it, it was just that window of time. Everything is perfect. He had nothing to do. He was home alone. He sat down with a glass of white wine, put the CD in the player, and listened to it. And I still get the hair on my arm standing up because this has been so important to my life and my dreams of doing a second album. He immediately called me when it's done. He goes, and he didn't even say hello. He goes, I said, hello. He goes, Robert, we were a really good band. And I said, who is this? I knew who it was from the accent and everything. He goes, it's Keith. I said, I know. What do you mean? He goes, we were really good. The plane, the fire in the plane, and the jamming we did. The ELP was more structured. And 3 had a lot of open-end things where you hear us live. We could go on for 3-4 minutes with Carl, Keith, and myself jamming, doing some stuff. And you hear Keith do some things you'd never hear anywhere else. It just, you all of a sudden he'd go into Walk Like an Egyptian or some silly song in the middle of a solo. You know, it's just, well, that's fun. And
so you definitely
it.
Weren't going to get that in ELP.
No, there wasn't any Bangles material.
Yeah.
So he really was excited. So I took that opportunity because it had been my dream to do a second album, but I would never talk to him about it because I knew it would hurt our friendship, I think, you know, for me to try to get him to do something that he felt was not good for his career. Now he was coming back to me saying, oh, my God. I can't believe how good this was. I don't know what I was thinking. So I said, Keith, what do you think about doing a follow-up? And he sort of calmed down. He goes, maybe. I said, let me call the record company and see what they say. They've been bugging me for 10 years. They've been bugging me so bad that I did a solo album for them just to, in the style that I love, which is kind of Asia 3, Yes, ELP, you know. It was called Dividing Line, and they really want this. He goes, okay, well, call me. I called him the next day and talked to Tina Frontiers. He said, when do we start? He was ready. I knew he'd be ready. Well, I said, well, here's our parameters. Give us complete artistic control. I want a year to do it. And Keith wants this much money. I want this much money. Of course, Keith wanted double what mine was. Yeah. You know, that was fine with me. and we didn't really pin down the amount of money. I just stated it that way. Called Keith back, but Keith, done deal. I got you this kind of money. He goes, you're kidding me. He goes, nobody cares anymore. Who wants that kind of money? I said, well, Frontiers care. You're Keith Emerson. I could always send that to him. You're Keith Emerson. What the hell's wrong with you? You know, come on. If you want what you do, and I really want to do it, and I really want us to work on something great. So he said, okay, let's do it. So I called Serafino back the next day, and funny enough, I upped Keith's amount, $10,000. Well, I talked to Keith. He's ready to do it, but he wants another $10,000 on top of that. I said, great, let's do it. Called Keith back. I said, hey, guess what? You think nobody cares? This guy, I got you another $10,000 on there. He was like, you should be my manager, he said. And that's what kickstarted the whole thing. Got excited. It was a good paycheck for him. Creative process. He and I got along really great. Since I was a keyboard player, my first band was inspired by Keith and had lots of lessons and stuff. We sort of spoke the same language even on keyboards. And then I played a lot of other instruments. So, I mean, we could discuss where it was going to go, how we were going to get there in real terms. You know, it wasn't like, oh, let's see what a drummer can do. No, we'll have a drummer do this. And, we spoke on the phone a lot. And we wrote and designed what the album was going to be. And
was there any talk of that. Carl coming back into the fold?
You know, I had asked Carl originally, when I wouldn't talk to Keith about it, I'd talk to Carl about it. We had almost done it a few times, but he's always so busy. He's playing all the time, this ELP legacy band, and they're really good, and he's sort of dedicated to it. And he did say, look, I'll do three songs. He wanted a lot of money to do that. And the rest of them, he says, you get somebody else. Forget it. And Keith and I, honestly, we wanted to use Simon Phillips. And Simon Phillips had done an ELP tribute album for me. And it was amazing what he did. And Keith knew Simon well. We had never talked to Simon about it. We never got to that point because we were going to add him on once all the keyboards and the vocals were done. That's what he did for me at the ELP tribute album. I rearranged everything, that Jordan Rooster keyboard stuff. Then I sent it to Simon. And it just gave him something extra that I'd never heard before by having all this stuff kind of going. He could play off all of it, which is the way Carl plays. Carl plays to the melody and the song itself, not especially to the beat, you know. So anyway, we got there. Carl wasn't going to do it, and we never did. We signed with us because, of course, we lost Keith at about 3 months into it.
And lyrically, this is a pretty heavy record. I've read where you've mentioned that the title track, The Rules Have Changed, was influenced by the loss of both Keith and Trent Gardner from the vastly underrated band Magellan.
Yeah.
You know, the song Our Bond tells of your relationship with Keith. Was it cathartic writing these songs, or was it something that was hard to express but you knew you had to get out?
You know, interesting for me, I've been asked this before, and I can't really explain it, because until I got the singing done, and I wrote the lyrics that came out of me, I didn't realize, I felt the place I was at, but I didn't realize it was sort of consuming me at the time, you know, and every word and everything I was doing. I was so intent on having the best vocal sound I could possibly do. I bought a $10,000 telephone and microphone to do vocals for myself. I wanted no excuses. as good as I could sing or as bad as I could sing, the quality of it was going to be good. How good that mic is, great. I purchased the latest Pro Tools. I had Pro Tools already, but I got the latest, greatest. I had the Moog rebuilder. Everything I did was dedicated to making this the best, and that was while Keith was alive, too. I had all the guitars, the basses, everything set up perfectly. You know, everything was going to be the best of what I had learned and the best of my capabilities. And it sort of it wasn't like tunnel vision. I guess it was, but mm-hmm. It was perfecting all the tools around me so I could organically do what I felt was right and what we had talked about. So in the lyrics, that came out, and then once I was done and sort of had to write out for a book and a CD and stuff, I saw them as a whole, and I realized that really the way I was feeling came out through my words. I can't explain any better than that. I wish I could. You know, it's just an organic process for a place and time where my mind and my heart was, and my focus on doing the best I could to honor what Keith and I had laid out in an outline form, kind of the process and what we were trying to achieve. I tried to finish that.
And yeah, it really comes across. It's interesting hearing you say, you know, talk about sort of the equipment and the recording process, because it's a pristine sounding record, but yet there's still emotion in it. And a lot of times those two things really don't go together. So it really is a great record.
Well, I appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Do you see 3.2 continuing on either with a tour or, you know, further studio projects, or was it just this one moment of time to sort of, you know, show your respects to Keith?
It's hard for me to answer that absolutely. I do have more things that Keith sent me and more things we've talked about that I didn't use, but what will never happen again are those phone calls where you're jamming, you know, him and his piano in his house, me and the piano in front of my Pro Tools, and him playing something like, so I'm going to put a damn Pro Tools right song from, I'm going plink, 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 about a third of the speed and maybe 80% of the notes. And he goes, no, you know, there's a thing in there. You play that A, and then there's a chord here. Oh, okay. And he sort of gave me this lesson on what he had just composed, and I'd put it down at half speed or three-quarter speed on my Pro Tools system. Then after we get off the phone, I would, you know, get it up, work on it, get up to full speed, because those parts were what I was going to use to write the song, the lyric part around. So that can never happen again. I just don't know. I there is going to be a tour, and we're planning that right now. I'm looking for an insane keyboard player, and I don't mean insane playing wise. A lot of guys can play it, but to take on the job of my 30 years in progressive rock, starting at the first three albums, and GTR, and Pilgrimage for a Point, and Dividing Line, and then my Magna Carta tribute series where I did Carnival 9 and Roundabout and some of these things. But we're going to do all that. And the guy's going to have to be crazy to say yes to that job, because it's going to be really hard. It's a dedication to playing all and learning it. Like I said, a lot of guys could play it, but someone has to be just a nut and have a great memory and respect the bands that are involved in that, like I do. You know? So I know that's going to happen. Now, I don't know about a follow-up album. 3.2 is not only just Keith and I doing it as the 0.2, but it, as in software language, it was the second version of 3.2, version 2. And, I being the only one, I shouldn't say that. You never know what Carl might say, hey, you did one with Keith, why don't you do one with me? Now, that would be something. I've never thought about it until that last, right there at that second, that popped out. That's kind of the way I am. I talk a lot, as you can see, and things come out. I have ideas all the time, but I haven't thought of that one.
Well, that's a good one. I like that one. And I think the tour would be amazing. I really look forward to catching that. In between, for the 30 years in between the two three records. You've kept a pretty diverse schedule of producing and performing. You know, you've had four great albums with Alliance, a number of tribute records, your solo stuff, your current position as bassist in the Greg Kinn Band. Do you have a preference when it comes to either your studio work or playing live?
You know, I got to tell you, my preference, because my mom sang in my dad's band, and nobody knew she was pregnant until 2 months before I popped out. I was actually in a band before I was born. I was sentenced to music, I think, because I'm just doing it all the time. I mean, I built a bass drum in high school in wood shop, a guitar in eighth grade. I built speaker cabinets. I owned the lighting system for my band Hush. I got involved on that. Like everything in music and that has to do with performing and recording it, if you saw my studio, it's like a museum, from the oldest Moog to the latest Pro Tools, kind of, you know. And the Hammond B3, a concert grand piano, everything in between. I'm just a nut for everything in music, and it's all the same for me, but I couldn't do just one of them. If I was just locked in the studio, I wouldn't be happy. I have to be on stage. But like with Greg, it's the best of all worlds, Greg Kinn. I not only co-wrote all the songs with him, but produced the album and recorded at my studio, but I get to go out and perform it live with him on the road. So it's kind of the best of all the stuff I enjoy. And that's why I want to get the 3.2 on the road, too, because that's not only going to be all the stuff that's so important to me, but it's going to be sort of my 30-year history. And a lot of people are going to know this. They're going to know a GTR song. They're going to know my tribute to Yes, Roundabout, where Steve Howe did it with me, and that type of stuff, you know. So I'm looking forward to that. But I have to do it all.
Definitely. And before I let you go, we do have to talk about one of my favorite projects of yours, December People. I've mentioned in a couple other interviews I've done, I got a thing for Christmas music. So I'm all in on this project. For those who don't know it, how would you describe the concept of December People? Because it's kind of brilliant.
And here's the problem. When I explain it, it seems simple. You're going to get it because you know what it is. We take the biggest classic rock songs, say Stairway to Heaven. Everybody knows Stairway to Heaven. McGlane, ZZ Top. Everybody knows that song. Everybody knows Don't Stop Believing by Journey, right? We take those iconic songs, and we take the holiday songs you grew up with as a kid. Santa Claus is coming to town. You know that song, right? That Bing Crosby probably did. Everybody did it. You've heard it forever. We do it like LaGrange. Oh, man, watch out. And it sounds like ZZ Top. And it's not the sound that's the most important part of it. It's that it fits like a glove. And that's the part that you can't get unless you see us live or you have an album. It could be Don't Stop Believing by Journey, but it's Angus Record on High, and everything in the Journey arrangement, the sound is there, and it fits into Angels Record on High, or vice versa, Angels Record on High fits into it. And I see the crowd, they're like, they kind of get the joke, I like to say. They go, damn, that sounds like it could have been on the Journey album. That could be the hit song. And it's hard to get that across, and you're hearing me say this, oh yeah. But if you've never heard it, it's a puzzle, and that's the cool part of it. When you figure out the puzzle pieces, and you figure out that Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen is I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, and all the different parts that are going on, it's just a lot of fun. I love doing it. We do it every year for the holidays. We play some shows for charity.
Yeah, it really is something where if you explain it to someone, they give you that strange look of that would never work. But once you hear it, I encourage everybody to take a listen, and you'll be hooked, because you know the music, you know the lyrics, and when you put them together like this, it really is a very cool combination.
And I will tell you, Magna Carta, the record label, called me, and they said, we want you to do a Christmas album. And I said, I don't want to do a Christmas album. Why not? Because if everybody, they sing Christmas songs. Like it's been done. I don't want to do it. I'm just not. I'll listen to what I got, you know. And they said, we want you to do a Christmas album. I said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. No, we need a Christmas album. We need to do it. And they were kind of tough about it because I did a lot of work for them. They said, you figure out how you can do what you're going to like to do. Click. Well, yes, sir. And I thought, well, okay, let me think about that. And that's when I came up with the December People concept. But I didn't know how it was going to work until I put together, trying to think of the first two. I think I put together Stairway to Heaven and The Night Before Christmas with a little bit of a Cashmere in the middle of it. And one other one, I think it was U2. And I sent it to him. I said, okay, well, here's what I'm thinking. If you let me do this, I'll do it. And they called me. They went, whoa, where'd this come from? I said, well, it's you only get an idea. They said, let's do it. It won record for the independent record companies. It won Christmas or Holiday Album of the Year that year. And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's a fun listen for this time of year. And
that's it.
Well, and again, Robert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk. Really look forward if you can get that tour put together for this record. I think your songs have come over amazing live along with, the rest of your history on there. And, keep in touch. Let me know when the tour comes. We'd be glad to get it out there. And, I wish you all the best and thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. You know, my publicist, John Lappin, will get a hold of you, and we'll meet in person when we come through the area.
That sounds great. I look forward to it.
Hi, man. Good talking to you.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay.